This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Your Radio Doctor does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, products, physicians, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on Your Radio Doctor. Always consult your own physician. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
Millions of Americans are losing their medical assistance or Medicaid coverage. If this affects you, Independence Blue Cross can help. You may be eligible to enroll in a health plan for as little as $0 a month. With Independence Blue Cross, you get the largest provider network in the area, including most Keystone First doctors and hospitals. We also offer free 24/7 telemedicine, coverage for hospital stays and prescriptions. See if you qualify for $0 health insurance and enroll today. Call Independence Blue Cross at 1-844-464-2583 or visit ibx.com/staycovered.
Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, WPHT HD, WOGL HD3, Philadelphia. From the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. It's time for the Delaware Valley's first radio doctor. On call every Saturday afternoon at 5. This is Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Listen, 7 months or 10 months is an absolutely exceptionally short time frame to produce this vaccine.
Your health determines your life, your longevity, and your happiness. Let your radio doctor lead the way with your medical education. Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie.
Good evening and welcome to Your Radio Doctor. I'm your host, Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Planning for our final days is a task that can be hard to face. End-of-life care is complex and emotionally challenging and unique for each person. Death can arrive suddenly, or a person may linger in a near-death state for days or weeks. Many patients are most afraid of not knowing what the process of dying is like. Will there be pain? The fear of being left alone at the end of their lives? Recognizing the terminal phase is important for patients, their families, and care providers, and allows realistic expectations and optimal management for physical suffering, as well as the emotional, social, and spiritual needs, because there is no algorithm that fits every case. Here to discuss this very important topic is Dr. John Traveling, my friend, from where we were practiced at Temple University Hospital together. John is a professor of thoracic medicine and surgery from the Lewis Katz School of Medicine at Temple University, has written over 120 publications in his field of pulmonary and critical care, as well as medical ethics, physician and patient communication, and end-of-life care. And he engages medical students and his colleagues in conversation about the dignity of each patient, especially the end of life. Welcome, John. It's so good for you to join us.
Thank you, Marianne. It's nice to be here.
So when we talk about end-of-life care, what does that involve?
Great question. Think of end-of-life care as really a broad category encompassing many facets of a person's life as they approach the final days of living here in this world. And I say it that way since many people, patients included, that I've encountered at least over the years, have some sense or a belief that life doesn't end here on earth. That is, that they have some sense that there may be life after death somewhere, somehow. So, but contextualizing this more in a medical or a healthcare arena, I think it'd be helpful to think of end-of-life care as really those aspects of care for a person by a physician or other members of a healthcare team when death is sort of in view for the patient, however long that may be before them. I'd like to, in terms of what it involves, I'd like to think of what I call domains in a person's life, and then the elements or the concerns that are proper to each of those domains. So, for example, we think of four, and you alluded to already, four domains of the physical, the psychological, the social, and spiritual dimension or domains of a person. In the physical domain, and we spend a lot of time as physicians and other healthcare providers do likewise, physical symptoms, pain, shortness of breath, nausea, vomiting, other GI symptoms, embarrassing things like incontinence, diminished appetite, weakness, and so on and so forth, delirium, altered consciousness, maybe paralysis. These are all obviously impairments in the physical domain, if you will, that may be amplified as one is in an end-of-life circumstance. Certainly physical, psychological matters, our emotions, anger, depression, anxiety, fear, sadness, all of these worry, all of these important elements that we do well to recognize in people at the end of life. In terms of social, in the social domain, I like to recognize isolation in association with disease. Maybe friends don't come over as much. They for whatever reason, we feel we may be isolated. Relationships with others that otherwise were intact may become strained and impaired. And I also like to think that, and people worry a lot about in end-of-life care, financial considerations for many people at the end of the life.
That is
an important element as well to be aware of. And then as in the spiritual domain, if you will, as I suggest, I think many people believe in something and something transcendent, something beyond themselves. But elements in this category might be something like forgiveness of oneself, perhaps for behaviors that may be contributed to their ill health or not, maybe forgiveness of others in their life that weighs on them. Certainly, as I said, beliefs are all part of it. What a person believes in is part of this. There may be doubts on the other side. And then practices of prayer or faith, if a person does subscribe to a belief system, certainly goes to the spiritual dimension of their care.
Well, what's interesting too, John, I'm the daughter of a funeral director. So I grew up seeing funerals in my home. And somewhere in the back of my little girl mind, I always thought when I would lose somebody that I'd be ready. Oh my goodness, I am just very hard to control emotions when I lose somebody close to me. Even sometimes I go to the funeral of somebody I've never met, but it's a friend's parent or loved one. And I find it very hard to control my own emotions. But you and I had a great conversation the other day, and end-of-life care is not just the hours before the breathing ceases or the heart stops beating. For somebody with a chronic illness, and you have multiple lenses, you take care of patients in intensive care, but you also see people with chronic lung issues, they're short of breath, et cetera, that can go on for years. You see people in their 80s. So what's wonderful about your approach, and you've told me this, we don't have the luxury of deciding how we're going to die. Mm-hmm. It can be sudden, it can be protracted, but I know you said that if you have an older person and they have chronic, you're wise enough to say, we should talk about this before death is on your doorstep for all the reasons you mentioned, so that when the time comes, you're at peace with saying goodbye to your family and loved ones. I've experienced watching patients or people I know say that somebody is sad when they lose a loved one. But sometimes it's even harder if they hadn't reconciled before it's over, because now that person's gone forever and they never had the chance. So you bring up such really beautiful thinking and so comprehensive. I'm sorry.
No, ahead. I think that's very true. That's very true. Many times we don't like to talk about death, particularly as physicians.
Right.
To talk about death, we sometimes view it sometimes as a failure, our failure, right? Letting a patient down, we failed a patient in some ways. So, and it's a very complex, as you know, as a physician, that whole dynamic, but sometimes having those feelings or those impediments to talking about end of life with a patient. I mean, patients often know what's happening, whether it's verbalized or not, many times. And it's important for a physician to maybe bring that up and to explicitly, you know, in gently and you know, in the proper way, raise the issue of you know, imminent death, if it is, or mm-hmm. or even if it's not, even if it may be months or even a few years away, who knows? You know, I often say, right, you know, no one really knows except one person how long any of us are going to live. But
right. Well, so we talk about the controlling the person's pain if they need a specific pain management and avoiding suffering. That's such an important issue. Then we want to address, as you say, not just the emotional needs of the patient, but their family members, and keep that dialogue going among the family, but between the provider, the doctor, the nurses, and it has to, life is dynamic. Mm-hmm. And so, as you say, you might bring people into the office, but then as the person's condition improves or declines, that we keep talking. So what might a patient and their family expect from us as healthcare providers?
Yeah.
I guess decisions about CPR, where a person wants to die, at home or in the hospital, organ donation. Let's talk about a few of those issues.
Well, sure.
Final few
sure.
minutes here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. good question. I think it's helpful to think maybe about expectations to first consider the various scenarios, right, and places where end of life encounters occur, such as an emergency room. You know, it may be totally unexpected, or on the other end, not that it's a continuum, but maybe in a hospice facility, things are a little bit more, you know, clear as to what's happening. Or in a hospital room, or an intensive care unit, or maybe at home, right? And stuff. So, and then, as you alluded to, also, you know, the circumstances surrounding end of life, whether it's an acute, sudden, often critical illness, or a non-acute process, but with known progression of the disease, like neurodegenerative, ALS or dementia, or whether it's not neither of that those, but something like states of permanent unconsciousness or chronic relapsing diseases, COPD, heart failure. Right. So, I, you know, what can patients and patients' family expect? I think for most part, we owe and we're trained, you know, they should expect and, you know, compassionate understanding from their caretakers, that pain, if it's mm-hmm. present, that it be managed. And that's not only possible, even in severe pain states, but it really is expected. I mean, we're just the advances in pain management these days, there really is no one that should be writhing, suffering in pain in first world medical care. They may expect other symptoms if pain is managed, or maybe pain is not at all a part of the end of life scenario, but other symptoms, as I alluded to earlier, GI symptoms, mm-hmm. respiratory symptoms, they can expect from healthcare providers maybe preemptive interventions to be taken. For example, mm-hmm. if a disease condition, if weight loss is anticipated, maybe as part of the clinical syndrome, a preemptive boosting of one's caloric intake. Maybe sometimes mm-hmm. that involves placing a feeding tube. There are very appropriate times right. where that needs to be done.
John?
Yes.
I'm going to ask us to take a little break
okay,
just for a
very
minute
good.
So we can listen to our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Dr. John Traveling from Temple.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, exclusively presented by Independence Blue Cross. If you have a question for the medical mailbag, just send a note to doctor@yourradiodoctor.net.
At Independence Blue Cross, we believe in giving you the tools you need to pursue your healthiest life. From premiums as low as $0 per month to health discounts and cash rewards, it pays to have coverage with Independence. With the strongest network of doctors and hospitals in the region and free 24/7 virtual doctor visits, you can feel confident that quality care is always within reach. Learn more about your coverage options at ibx.com.
When Recovery Centers of America at Devon opened its campuses on the Main Line and in South Jersey, they offered a new approach, local addiction treatment led by an expert, caring team of professionals. RCA has since helped thousands and leads the way in innovative programs and exceptional inpatient and outpatient care, all in a beautiful setting that allows for healing and recovery. RCA answers the phone and admits patients 24/7, 365, including the holidays. All admitted patients and staff are routinely tested for COVID-19. Call now at 1-888-RECOVERY. That's 1-888-RECOVERY.
When we ask questions, we make sure they're the big ones. Like, how can the healthcare industry earn the trust of patients? And what if your health outcomes and access to care weren't defined by your skin color, sexuality, gender, or zip code? At Genentech, we're removing barriers and partnering across the medical community to make clinical research as diverse as the world we serve to ensure communities have access to healthcare. Learn how we are working to make healthcare more equitable at gene.com/askbiggerquestions.
Back to your radio doctor. We're talking with Dr. John Traveling from Temple University Hospital about end-of-life care. And John, you're explaining this so beautifully to our listeners, because I don't know that the average person, I don't think I'm ever going to die. I guess I am, like death and taxes. I guess I have to face it, but we all prefer not to. But it's important so that when the time comes, both the patient and the family members are comfortable and prepared, because there are details like, what if you have, and as we said, there is no one template for everyone. Every case is unique. Let's say the idea of a feeding tube comes up. A lot of people shudder at the thought of a feeding tube. As a GI doc, I've placed hundreds, thousands of them. And if somebody's temporarily in a coma from a car accident and then their brain heals, we've kept them alive in a healthy way with a feeding tube. It's a good thing. But we probably wouldn't boost the calories in a person who's so terminally ill, right? So there, that might be an issue. Feeding tube, CPR, let's talk about that for a minute. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Are we going to do CPR on somebody who's really in their last days if their heart should stop? Like, that's something that a family would have to give an answer, yes or no?
Yeah, excellent question. It comes up so often, particularly in the critical care setting that I spend a lot of time in. You know, CPR is very appropriate in certain cases, but there are many cases, particularly surrounding end-of-life care or end-of-life circumstance of a person where to subject a person to resuscitative maneuvers really confers no benefit for the patient. In fact, may be harmful. But the cases, as you said, are so varied and unique that it's hard to make generalization. But families can expect, and patients themselves, if they're conscious and have capacity, can expect to from their healthcare team to hear about the possibility of whether resuscitative efforts, should they be otherwise called for, should they be done. And again, it's an important conversation to have. Mm-hmm. It's not something across the board that that is appropriate or proper to a patient's care.
And we talk about where a patient prefers to pass away. You might think that being at home is the most peaceful, but for the caregivers, that might be really frightening, because as a person starts to weaken, either from their illness or maybe sedation or a metabolic disturbance, like high levels of calcium that comes with some cancers, the person can't eat. They can't drink. So we say, okay, we don't want them to drink liquids. It's easier to aspirate that. So we'll do full liquids, just small things like that that can still keep the person hydrated. A person's more comfortable when they're hydrated, but we're not going to jump to IV fluids. Like, just that little example has helped us so much. You teach a family how to do mouth care with the little sponge sticks. It keeps the person's mouth. Yes. Just those little steps, because, and we tell them, expect breathing changes, expect the breathing to become more labored, because they panic. So maybe in some cases it's better to let the person die in the hospital. What do you think about that general question?
Well, I would agree with that. Sometimes the commonly said you know, idiom, sometimes less is more. And, you know, it's about the patient and about caring for the patient and the needs of them, trying to minimize any harms and doing things that are truly for their benefit or that we believe is for the benefit of the patient. Sometimes patients cannot be, as much as they may want to, as much as a family may want to care for them in the home situation. It just is not possible. They require too much care, nursing care, support to be cared for properly at home. And it's actually would not be to their benefit and very appropriate to be in a hospital type situation or a facility that can meet their needs as the end approaches, as the end nears.
Because people who provide those comfort measures all day, every day can anticipate, gee, this person's getting weaker, their breathing has changes. They know to say to the person's spouse or child, this is what we expect. We're going to give a little comfort medication to ease the difficulty breathing. Let's talk about the difference, if we could, between palliative care and hospice care. I think that's confusing for the average person.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. I think it's an important distinction to be aware of. Palliative care in a broader sense or is a broader view of care for patients, whether at the end of life or not. The timeline, so to say, is much longer, right? Interventions, medical treatments, and so on aim not so much at cure, but making better symptoms, palliating, that's the term used, right, to make better, to allay symptoms, making someone feel better in the midst of the disease process they're going through.
What are some examples, John? Like somebody's had a stroke and a nurse turns them in the bed, that kind of thing?
Yeah. That, you know, just basic care to prevent for complications. Sometimes that's like that example. Pain is an important, you know, I know we're emphasizing it, but that's just so common. But adequate pain management and control of the patient's pain is palliation. Sometimes morphine, it's a old but very useful and very effective drug for breathlessness.
Yes, I think people need
comfortable.
To. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we think of it as pain management. And that's accurate as well, but it has a very important use in palliating, making better, lessening a person's air hunger, sense of difficulty breathing. Andrew, the other comment I would like to make about the palliative care model is many times treatments, let's say for cancer, the cancer treatments are able to be continued. They're, quote, permitted in a person that's undergoing palliative care. Now, in hospice care, to distinguish it from palliative care, for one, the timeline is much shorter. In fact, years, decades ago, Medicare guideline concerning hospice care had adopted had adopted a six-month sort of timeline, and many agencies follow that. That is a disease process or circumstance for the patient where death is reasonably expected to occur within 6 months, recognizing, of course, that there's nothing firm or absolute about that. Many people, many times people will live in hospice care.
John, let me interrupt you just for a second there. So something that stands out in my mind, if somebody's palliative care, let's say they're getting chemo and yes, you want to treat their pain or their constipation, that sort of thing. But palliation might be, I'm going to put a commode next to your bedside because you have a cancer spread to your leg. We want to, you know, those kind of daily quality of life improvements. Mm-hmm. And if a person on chemo that has a pretty good chance of several years and they get appendicitis, we're going to operate. If somebody's in hospice, we say, we're probably not going to operate anymore. Real clear, right?
Yes. Hospice care really, as I suggested earlier, treatments may be permitted in palliative care model. But in hospice care, really the focus is almost exclusively on palliative care things, like you mentioned, but not treatments, no therapies such as radiation or chemotherapy for the patient with cancer or certain medications for heart failure in the person who's in hospice with terminal heart disease. So that's an important thing. And treatments are really off limits, so to say, in hospice care, treatments aimed at altering a disease, but it's really making a person feel better, palliating, making them feel better, treating their symptoms, anything that gives them comfort and lessens any sense of distress.
Mm-hmm. John, what do you teach your medical students and residents in the intensive care unit, your medicine surgery residents? What do you teach them about end-of-life care?
Yeah, I first want them to know some of the major ingredients that go into good end-of-life care. I think it's important for them, for example, to recognize values of the patient. That's so important. I think it's important for them to recognize a patient's autonomy. They're although not an absolute principle of ethics, that the patient makes the decisions for themselves to the extent that they can do that. I think it's important to recognize beliefs that the patient may have, whatever they are. I emphasize it's important to have a basic skill set, right, to the students and trainees, that they know their medicine well, that they know and understand the disease, they understand the prognosis of the disease, the course, and all of that goes into just good medical care, that they know how to apply treatments, again, pain management, symptom management for GI distress, for respiratory distress. These are all, but probably the one most critical thing that I'd like to convey to students across the board is the distinction between therapy and care. I drill this in so much with it because it's so misunderstood. Therapy having to do with treating a particular pathology, care having to do with showing interest or concern of the patient, independent of any pathology. And I always say to them, and this comes up when we talk about withdrawing medical therapy, sometimes very appropriate, but that we should always care for patients, even if we don't have treatments or therapies to offer them.
Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit earlier, we have about a minute left in this segment, but along with the emotional needs of the patient who's in fear of dying or they become agitated, the importance of family dynamics. We talked about bringing the patient in for discussion, but say, what family members would you like to join us in this conversation? I think that's brilliant that you do that. And when we come back from the break, I wanted to get your thinking on the idea of forgiveness, a patient forgiving himself or herself, or making amends with those family members or friends so that everybody's at peace when the final moment comes. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. So important. So important.
Mm-hmm. Stay with us during the break and we'll be back for more conversation about end-of-life care. And now for your real champion. I call this segment Super Sibs. For a child to lose a parent to cancer is heartbreaking, but when a parent loses a child to cancer, it goes against all the rules of natural order. Childhood cancer. The American Cancer Society reports that after accidents, cancer is the second leading cause of death in children ages 1 through 14. Imagine being the child with cancer, dealing with pain, nausea, fever, fear of needles, maybe surgery, losing your hair, seeing other kids go to school and be with their friends, missing birthday parties, sports, and sleepovers. Now imagine being the parent of a child with cancer. Worry about doctor visits, medical bills, wondering how much time you have left together, missing work, sheer exhaustion, and fear of going to sleep in case you don't hear your child call for help. Now, step into the shoes of a sibling to the child with cancer. They aren't the ones who are sick, but the rhythm of their lives is disrupted too. When mom and dad focus on their sick brother or sister, who's there to check their homework, hear about their tough day, or plan their birthday party? Well, many of you have heard of Alex's Lemonade Stand. This is an organization that was formed about a year after Liz and Jay Scott lost their 8-year-old daughter to cancer. The mission? is to change the lives of children with cancer through impactful research, raising awareness, and supporting families with a child going through cancer. Since the start in 2005, the fund has raised over $250 million, which goes to research projects at over 150 institutions in America and Canada, and a Travel for Care program that supports families of children receiving treatment. But another very special part of the mission is the Super SIBS program. They recognize that childhood cancer affects the whole family, not just the sick child undergoing treatment. Brothers and sisters worry about their sick sibling and don't always understand what's happening. I'm sure that many wonder if they could get the same sickness. The mission of Super SIBS is to comfort, encourage, and empower siblings of children with cancer so they can also face the future with courage and hope. Super SIBS includes kids from ages 4 through 18, developmentally based with groups from ages 4 through 7, 8 through 12, and 13 through 18. The two-year program includes materials that come in the mail that help with coping, encouragement, maybe a birthday gift, or just something fun with their name on it. And there's a special guide for teens. The staff at Alex's notifies parents to expect the package, and materials might include a discussion about jealousy, anger, or even back-to-school plans. When siblings complete the program, they get a medal. If they want, they can re-enroll and become an ambassador and talk about their family or volunteer at an event. When a child asks, "Why does my brother always get mail?" but then the child gets one with lemons and it helps them feel like it's not just the sick child getting the attention. They too are seen. They are not alone. Super SIBS works with hospitals across the country who make referrals. They also connect with social workers, child life workers. In addition, there's a grief and loss program, which offers ways to remember and honor a lost brother or sister. What a brilliant and thoughtful program to remember children in a family dealing with childhood cancer when they might otherwise feel forgotten. We salute you, Alex, her parents, Liz and Jay Scott, and all the staff at Alex's Lemonade Stand. You're real champions. Learn more about the beautiful work of Alex's Lemonade Stand and their Super SIBS program on their website, alexslemonade.org. That's Alex's without an apostrophe, A-L-E-X-S, lemonade.org.
Today's edition of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross, can be enjoyed anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. Just download the Odyssey app and search Your Radio Doctor. It's health education on demand.
Millions of Americans are losing their medical assistance or Medicaid coverage. If this affects you, Independence Blue Cross can help. You may be eligible to enroll in a health plan for as little as $0 a month. With Independence Blue Cross, you get the largest provider network in the area, including most Keystone First doctors and hospitals. We also offer free 24/7 telemedicine, coverage for hospital stays and prescriptions. See if you qualify for $0 health insurance and enroll today. Call Independence Blue Cross at 1-844-464-2583 or visit ibx.com/staycovered.
When we ask questions, we make sure they're the big ones. Like when it comes to diseases, can we strive to treat, prevent, and even reverse them? And how can we make healthcare more effective and more affordable? These are the types of questions that can help impact the lives of so many patients, that help push the boundaries of innovation and healthcare for all communities. At Genentech, we are the pioneers of the biotech industry, tackling some of the biggest questions in healthcare. Learn more at gene.com/askbiggerquestions.
Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, now Saturday afternoons at 5, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC.
Welcome back to Your Radio Doctor for a very important conversation about end-of-life care. Our friend Dr. John Travelling is a pulmonary and critical care specialist who sees patients in intensive care on a daily basis and also takes care of chronically ill people in the office. John, we were talking about facing end of life and forgiveness. Just that one word brings out so many thoughts and so many emotions. How do you bring that word up with your patients and their families?
Yeah, good question. Also, I've reflected over the years that we are as human beings, we're made for relationships, whether we're married or not, whether we have close family relationships or not, whether we're really close with friend relationships or not, it doesn't matter, because all of us, I think, are made to be in relationships with one another. And we need that. We need the connectedness with other human beings. This business of forgiveness came up with me over the years as I sort of would see how people would be deeply hurt and pained and distressed emotionally, spiritually, because of rupture, if you will, and connectedness with other people. We're made to be connected. We do well when we're connected with other people.
And boy, did we learn that with COVID, that the isolation just is now considered, the Surgeon General says that's a health risk, and rightly so, as you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the degree that certain things may separate us from those who are close to us that we love and, calls for forgiveness, which I see basically as a way of bridging or reconnecting with someone else. Maybe for past wrongs or misunderstanding or whatever the circumstance particulars might be. But I think that's particularly important, and especially so at the end of life, because, we want to be reconciled, if you will, to use that word. We want to forgive. We want to be forgiven, I would say, because it's for our benefit.
Well, it's such a gift, too, because especially if the person dying, if you think they didn't understand what your comment or gesture meant, you have to live with it. And once they're gone, and, you hear about siblings or relatives that just say, nope, I don't care. But boy, does it hurt even more once the opportunity is lost. Physician-assisted suicide. I think Oregon was the first state to legalize that in 1997-ish or so. And I love your impression of that, that oftentimes a person doesn't want to say, all right, next Thursday at 5 o'clock, I'm going to take the, it's more sometimes in your own words.
Yeah.
A plea.
Yeah. 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 Physician assisted suicide or aid in dying, it goes by various terms, became legalized in the United States, and I think it was 94, but then there was some injunction. So it really goes into effect in Oregon, was the first state in 1997. And I think it is now legal in 10 of the United States, 10 of the states in the country, and of course in other countries as
well. I think you captured it so well, John, when you said sometimes when that fear, it's a person's plea for help. They're looking for hope.
Yeah, yeah. My experience, it's not legalized in the state of Pennsylvania, so my experience is rather limited. But times I am asked, believe it or not, I'm asked over the years for patients, one case, a patient's family asking for physician assisted suicide. And but what I see it as an opportunity to further care for the person. It's in a sense, I think, is an expression that more was needed in the care for that patient or the patient's family. And I've come to really see that all the requests for assisted suicide or euthanasia or anything in that area is really a plea, is really a calling out for help, a patient or a patient's family looking for help to keep on hoping when things appear to be hopeless. So I think if we sort of focus from a caregiver standpoint, or even from the patient standpoint, why am I asking to end this all? Maybe, ask the question, have I lost hope? Where can I find hope? I think there is always hope, by the way. And so but we don't always see it. It appears to be, we appear to have lost hope, but I think it's always there. And so maybe to just go a little bit deeper maybe and say, what am I asking for? Do I really want to end my life? I suspect that's not the case if we go a little bit deeper.
Well, and just, as scientists, we look for data or evidence from the past. And a study came out in New England Journal. Yeah. In the year 2000 from Oregon. Oh, there were 4,000 people, and they got responses from over 2,600 patients. Half of them who had requested physician assistance to die,
changed their minds. Yeah.
Once the physician said, let's tweak this, let's get better pain control, or let's give you an antidepressant med, or refer to hospice, which brings us to your experience in including cultural and religious traditions into the planning, because there's such important aspects of care, because it may affect your communication. It may affect how they want their pain managed, whether they want to donate their organs, traditions at death, or even during bereavement. All those issues can relate to cultural practices or their religious traditions. Tell us about that if you want.
Yeah, and more and more we're in a more diversified society, religious traditions, cultural differences, more than I think ever, at least in my experiences. So, and they're very varied, right? And different. Sometimes we can, it's interesting, sometimes there can be signs, we walk into a patient's room that we can infer what their beliefs may be or what particular religious tradition they might subscribe to. Sometimes they tell us. Sometimes we know that their beliefs are important because they tell us, or their family does, or we might know their particular religious tradition if they identify it as such on their admission record, for example.
Because there's a box that a patient can check, right? When you're admitted to the hospital, one of the things that became law is we have to ask people if they have a living will. That's a whole separate show. But what is your religion? What is your practice? Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Muslim? So that when the need arises, we can call for a priest, a rabbi, an imam, a minister. But I always tell my patients, remember, if the nurse is busy, the doctor, it might not come into their mind. Make sure you ask, because temple has priests, most major medical centers have that designated priest that serves your community, or minister or imam, but maybe not. So check into that as well. Yes.
Yes, yes. We have at Temple a phenomenal palliative care service, a team.
There you go.
Multidisciplinary team who are involved with palliative care, as we discussed. And when hospice care is appropriate, they help usher patients in that direction as well. And they many times are the brokers, if you will, for the connections with religious leaders and officials that that the patient may request. And they facilitate them being present to be with the patient and to express the various whatever their particular tradition calls for, if you will. I know the Catholics have a particular sacrament. Many times faithful Protestant patients, many people come into the room and prayer occurs at the bedside with the patient, and so on. I think there's a blessing by Jewish rabbis in situation. So there are so many dimensions to this as well, as you said. But an important element of end of life.
It's about providing that peace to the family, the patient, and feeling like they did everything they possibly could for that moment when it arrives. John, what about any cultural dimensions that come up in particular? Outside of religion?
Yeah, I think so there too. It's more religious. What came to my mind was refusing certain, but often there are some cultural things that refer to that come to mind over care of the body after death or organ donation, for example. Again, it sort of blurs with sometimes religious traditions, but I don't think it's contrasted as such. I mean, there's a blend, whether religious or cultural things. I don't know. Were you thinking of something in particular that I?
No,
there's more, quote, purely cultural.
Well, as you say, when people from around the world, we're all globetrotters now, and our major medical centers, Temple, Jefferson, we do see people from around the world. I did my training at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and the first day I had a patient from Greece, a patient from Turkey. And I was spellbound because they didn't die, fortunately. But I think of those cases that you want to be sensitive. And,
yeah, it's just as I was talking and thinking about that, I know some cultural things that differences that inform or cultures that inform whether a patient wants to know about their condition. You know, actually their diagnosis and their prognosis. And it's come up a few times over the recent years where families don't want the patient, and it's a cultural thing, don't want the patient. They tell us explicitly, don't tell the patient about their prognosis. Mm-hmm. And so we have to navigate that. And
that's a really tough issue, because if somebody says, don't tell grandmom that she's going to die. And what I usually say is, you know what? The relationship is between me and your grandmother, and you don't want a doctor who fibs. I mean, that's my polite way of bringing it around to, because the dying person usually can sense that it's the end.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's just interesting that there are some differences, but it requires a lot of discussion and with the family and with the patient. And as you said, often the relationship we have is with the patient and the duty to the patient. So often it is letting them know, not contrary per se, but in an appropriate, gentle, and agreeable way.
That's the word. A gentle, truthful way, because that's what, in the end, that's what people appreciate most, that that you're honest honest, and that you have a heart as well. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back for our wrap-up with Dr. John Travelline.
Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie is presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Good evening. I'm Stephanie Lewis, Clinical Director for Recovery Centers of America at Devon, and one of your addiction experts from RCA. Today, I'm here to talk to you about Thriving in Sobriety, Tips to Cure Boredom in Recovery. After months or years of engaging in addictive behaviors, finding purpose and excitement in everyday life can be difficult. Here are some smart recovery tips to help you cultivate a fulfilling and meaningful life in sobriety while avoiding the pitfalls of boredom and relapse. So some ideas include: find a new hobby or passion, volunteer in the community, engage in physical exercise and outdoor activities, connect with others in recovery, learn a new skill or take a class, travel and explore new places, practice mindfulness. It's important to recognize that recovery is a lifelong journey. Even after the initial stages of recovery, you must continue to grow and change to maintain your sobriety. If you or a loved one needs help with alcohol or drugs, reach out to Recovery Centers of America at 833-969-0268 or visit rcaradiodoctor.com. That's rcaradiodr.com. We answer the phone and admit patients 24/7.
I'm always striving to live my healthiest life, so I need a health plan that has my back. With Independence Blue Cross, I get access to the largest network of doctors and hospitals in the region and free virtual doctor visits 24/7. Plus, with premiums as low as $0 per month, I can stay on top of my health and keep my budget in check. Independence has given me coverage I can count on, and they'll do the same for you. Learn more about your coverage options at ibx.com.
Now, your weekly prescription, brought to you by Genentech, the science-driven company that pioneered the biotech industry to transform how we treat the world's most complex health problems.
And in our last segment of Your Radio Doctor, we call this segment Your Weekly Prescription as we wrap up the show. Dr. John Travelline, you've shared beautiful information and really giving our listeners hope to understand that when they, as the patient or their family members or close friends, reach that last moment in time, that there are people like you spending all day, every day, being ready to help with that passage to the next life. John, one of the things that I think people need to understand, if a person, a patient dies in the hospital, they're officially pronounced as expired by a physician. If you have a loved one at home, as soon as the person has expired, you need to contact your physician or hospice care so they can have someone come and officially pronounce the person as gone, that they've gone. So that's important.
Correct.
And I think the other thing I'd love to hear your take on, anything you add is wonderful, but we've all grown up hearing that the last sense to leave the sick and dying patient is their hearing. So even though they might be in coma, we remind family and friends to be by the bedside, and your familiar voice or your touch or even music they like is bringing them such comfort because they know you're there. I know my own precious mother, I would come home, feed the kids, get them to bed, and go back at like 7 and just sit with her all night in case she opened her eyes for a millisecond. I want to say, I'm here, Mom, you know, and I stayed with her every millisecond. My dad was there on the final day with my sister. He was tired. She brought him home, and my mother seemed stable. And then they weren't gone for a half hour and her breathing started to change. And I must have panicked. The phone in her room didn't work. I left the room to call and she slipped away. And I think the dying person often waits for that moment so they don't crush you. They don't, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, all kinds of, you know, testimonies like that. You know, for as sad as the loss of someone is because of death, it can be a very beautiful experience, believe it or not. And I know you believe it because you've seen it and you've experienced it.
Oh, yeah.
But it can be a very beautiful, peaceful experience. I too have learned that hearing is one of the last of our senses to go. So even as a person, maybe as they're dying, slips into unconsciousness and appears comfortable, but may have some labored breathing or whatnot, and medicines are given to make them appear more comfortable and to be comfortable. I think some of the most beautiful things I've seen is a spouse at the bedside whispering, or a child, either whispering or out loud speaking to the patient, "Dad, I love you. Mom, I love you." And continuing that as they take their last breath, it could be such a beautiful thing. So, I would encourage if people have that opportunity. Again, for as sad as it is, it could be the most beautiful thing. I'd like to just one comment in closing, say that I have to say, in my decades of practice, what really is good news in this area of end-of-life care is that we have gotten so much better palliative care, so much better. In fact, so much so that it's its own medical specialty now, hospice care, so much better than it ever was over the decades. And we pay more attention in medicine to the patients in their last moments of death. We're cognizant, we're aware of the hope that that patients crave in the last moments, and that the family craves for their loved one. And I think it's really good to know that, and it's happening, that we're so much better at providing, I think, superior end-of-life care. Would encourage families, patients in these situations to expect that from their physicians, from their nurse and other healthcare providers.
Well, you
because
say
it's there.
Yeah, and you say
offer.
It so well and so beautifully, John, and you live the message. And Temple University and any patients that experience your care and your presence are very blessed to have you in the picture, because it's not an easy departure. But as you say, it can be beautiful, especially if you put everybody's comfort first, as you do. So thank you so much for joining us. Dr. John Traveling from Temple University, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you for listening to Your Radio Doctor. Tune in every Saturday at 5 p.m. here on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. You can listen to this show or any of our segments, including Your Real Champion, Your Addiction Prevention Tip, on Audacy.com. That's AUDACY.com. A special thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Independence Blue Cross, and to Recovery Centers of America. If you would like to partner in the show and support our effort to provide medical education to the community, send an email to info@yourradiodoctor.net. Tell us about a champion in your world, family member, your workplace, the community. Send us the story to info@yourradiodoctor.net. To all of our fathers, grandfathers, expectant fathers, we wish you a wonderful, happy Father's Day tomorrow. I hope you're surrounded by the children who love and appreciate you so much. And kids, remember to thank your daddies and your granddads for all their hard work to protect you and teach you life's lessons. This is your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, wishing you a happy, healthy, and safe week with the ones you love. And always here to remind you that your health is your wealth.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross. To contact Dr. Marianne and to listen to today's show as well as past shows, visit yourradiodoctor.com. This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Audacy. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
Millions of Americans are losing their medical assistance or Medicaid coverage. If this affects you, Independence Blue Cross can help. You may be eligible to enroll in a health plan for as little as $0 a month. With Independence Blue Cross, you get the largest provider network in the area, including most Keystone First doctors and hospitals. We also offer free 24/7 telemedicine, coverage for hospital stays and prescriptions. See if you qualify for $0 health insurance and enroll today. Call Independence Blue Cross at 1-844-464-2583 or visit ibx.com/staycovered.